It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll meet Milwaukee's 2016 Artists of the Year, a visual artist and a poet and novelist.
First, today, the U.S. Supreme Court announced their decision to overturn a Texas abortion law passed in 2013. The law required abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. In a 5-3 decision, justices ruled that the Texas law created an unconstitutional burden on women seeking an abortion.
The decision sets a national precedent that could limit how far states can go in restricting abortion rights. Experts say it's a win for abortion rights advocates. Supporters, though, of the overturned law say its purpose was to protect women and make abortion safer. The Republican Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, said the Supreme Court's decision was, quote, a devastating blow to the protection of the health and safety of women in Texas.
Emily Martin joins us now to talk more about this case and how it could affect abortion rights throughout the country. She's General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center, which opposed the Texas law. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with a quick review of that Texas law in question, HB 2. What parts of the law specifically were being challenged?
So there were two key parts that the Supreme Court was considering. One part of the law required doctors performing abortions in clinics in Texas to have admitting privileges at a hospital less than 30 miles away from the clinic. The other key part of the Texas law required all abortion clinics to meet the facility standards, the construction standards that are applicable to ambulatory surgical centers in Texas. So in other words, to really have pretty advanced technology available, things like really broad hallways so stretchers could go past each other. And those things might on their face sound reasonable, but there were lots of reasons why these provisions didn't really do anything to make abortion safer in Texas, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court found today. And I'm happy to chat about that a little more.
Well, what would you say that the two sides had to say? You gave a little bit of what your group has said about the law. I understand that we heard the Texas governor saying that the law was in place to make abortion safer for women, to protect women and families. What do you say to that?
What I say to that is what the law did and what the law was absolutely intended and expected to do was shut down clinics around the state of Texas. More than half of clinics in Texas have closed since HB 2 passed, and another chunk of those were expected to close if the Supreme Court upheld HB 2, which meant in lots of places in Texas, women were hundreds of miles away from an abortion provider, which meant that women were seeking abortions later in pregnancy because there were longer wait times, because they had to take extra time to save money to travel hundreds of miles and get a hotel room overnight because of other restrictions that Texas puts on abortion, which means that it's a multi-day procedure where you get counseled the first day, have to come back the next day for the procedure. So all of those things meant that women were less able to access abortions, and when they were accessing them, it was often later in their pregnancy, which makes abortion more complicated. So for those reasons, it really was harming women's health in critical ways.
So where did this law stand before this decision came down today?
So where the law stood before this is that parts of it had been stayed. There were parts of the law that had not gone into effect yet, and that's why if the Supreme Court had not struck down these provisions, we would have expected to see more clinics close. However, parts of the law had already gone into effect, and that's why we'd already seen a lot of clinics close. So, for example, the admitting privileges piece had led to a lot of clinics closing, because if you work in an abortion clinic, you very rarely have to transfer anyone to a hospital precisely because abortion is so safe. It's safer than colonoscopies. It's safer than liposuction. It's safer than getting your wisdom teeth removed. And many hospitals won't allow you to have admitting privileges unless you admit a certain number of patients a year. So ironically, the very safety of abortion was preventing doctors from meeting the requirements set out in HB 2. And so when the admitting privileges rule went into effect, clinics around the state closed.
Now, this decision was being hailed, even before the decision broke, as a sort of a referendum on the way Roe v. Wade would be understood going forward. So what do you think, given the decision, what do you think we now know about that question?
What we know because of this decision is that there continue to be strong constitutional protections for women who are seeking abortion, and that's critically important. We know that the Supreme Court and thus the lower courts will not accept a assertion that a particular restriction forwards women's health if there isn't any actual evidence showing that this restriction forwards women's health. We know that courts are not going to close their eyes to the actual impact of abortion laws when it harms women, when it puts women at greater risk, just because the proponents of those laws claim this is really in women's best interest. And that is a very important victory.
We're talking with Emily Martin right now, General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. That group opposed the Texas law, which was overturned today. And Emily, can you walk us through how the votes came down on the court today? Any surprises?
Sure. So it was a 5-3 decision. Justice Breyer wrote the majority decision and was joined by Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Kennedy. Now, Justice Kennedy was widely thought to be the swing vote in this case, and definitely all eyes were on him in the lead-up to the case, in the oral argument, where it was hard to tell exactly where he was going to come down. Some of the questions he asked in oral argument, in retrospect, I think, give some guidance to what his thinking was, what led him to join the majority here. Some of the questions that he asked in oral argument really pushed on this idea that what the evidence showed was that by imposing these requirements, which led to clinic closures around the state, women were less able to get early abortions. They were less able to get medication abortions, abortions that you can have because of a pill without any sort of surgical procedure at all. And Justice Kennedy, I think, was rightly concerned that that was a really perverse result of a bunch of laws that were supposed to be protecting women's health.
Now, you mentioned the clinics that had closed in the wake of this law being enacted, portions of it. Will those same clinics open, do you think, in quick order, or what has to happen if that's the case?
So I do believe that either many of those clinics will reopen or other clinics will open in underserved areas. There are providers in Texas who are really committed to women's health, to ensuring that women in Texas have the full range of reproductive health care options. Now, I am sure that there will be some bumps in the road, that the Supreme Court unfortunately can't wave a magic wand and turn back the clock, that these clinics will face some barriers in trying to get back on their feet. But I think that we will see women's reproductive health care coming back to Texas and back to these underserved areas.
Now, here in Wisconsin, we have a law similar to HB 2, which would require doctors who perform abortions to have hospital admitting privileges. And that law was struck down by the courts, but most recently a federal appeals court. So is the whole women's health decision any indication of what the future of Wisconsin's law might hold in other states that have similar laws?
Yeah, I think that the whole women's health decision is a pretty clear message that Wisconsin's law is unconstitutional, that I would expect that the Supreme Court would not take up that law, which, as you say, was struck down last year as an unconstitutional restriction on women's right to access reproductive health care. And I think more broadly, the decision today is a message to politicians in states around the country that there are real restrictions on their ability to target abortion providers with these unnecessary provisions that have the effect of closing down clinics, of driving abortion providers out of states, and that the courts are going to continue to take a hard look at those provisions and really require some evidence that they are protecting women's health, that they are promoting good medicine, which in the great majority of instances they simply aren't.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emily Martin, General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. That group opposed the Texas law that was just overturned today.
Milwaukee recently named its 2016 Artists of the Year. This year, they are visual artist Della Wells and writer Dasha Kelly.
Della Wells creates collages and dolls celebrated by art critics for their bright and whimsical design while addressing issues that are serious, like mental illness.
And Dasha Kelly is a poet whose spoken word is lettered to HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. Her most recent novel, Almost Crimson, is a story of a complex relationship between mother and daughter. The two artists join us now to tell us more about their work and making art and being creative in Milwaukee. Della, thanks for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you.
And Dasha, welcome to the show. Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, Della, let's start with you. Quilts, collages, dolls, children's book illustrations. What kind of things do you keep coming back to? What inspires you to create this art?
Life, people that I know. I make art. Instead of getting mad at people, I make art. And and I like fairy tales. As a child, I like reading fairy tales and myths. And fairy tales I find in, cartoons. Like, grew up with Mighty Mouse and those sort of things. But fairy tales are very, promoted as being very sweet, but they're also very dark.
And as I understand it, you didn't start out in life thinking of yourself as an artist or making art. You started in your 40s, I think it was. So what led you to start creating?
Well, actually, what started me to start creating was at the time I was going to Milwaukee Area Technical College, and I was studying to be a psychologist, and my advisor at the time told me I needed some humanities, so I took an art survey course. I knew a little bit about art survey. In the early 70s, I used to be involved with an African-American art gallery in Milwaukee that... called Gallery Toward the Black Aesthetics. To make a long story short, I wrote a paper on an artist in Milwaukee, Evelyn Patricia Terry, and she remembered that I drew Picasso-like drawings, and she was trying to get me to do art for 2 years.
And you finally started doing it.
I finally did, yeah.
And Dasha, let's bring you in now. Poetry, fiction, this new novel, Almost Crimson. Can you tell us about Almost Crimson a little bit, please?
Sure. It's the story of a woman who, she grows up with a mother that has a debilitating form of depression. So she goes through the cycles as a child of not understanding and then being afraid of being taken and then being protective of her mother and then being angry that they're both in a situation and then ultimately resigning herself that this is just going to be her forever lot in life, taking care of this woman and waiting for her own mental illness, her crazy gene, as she calls it, to explode. As an adult, she has an opportunity to realize a different present for the both of them, and then she realizes that codependency is also a very real thing. So it definitely does navigate how she ended up in the space where she is, how she's able to reimagine, and you can reimagine your youth, but it already happened, so how do you move forward? How do you ask yourself questions? How do you redefine adult relationships, and how do you also broker this conversation about mental health and mental illness and all of the phases that come in between?
And Dasha, this is a novel. You also write poetry. You perform it live. What's different between writing and creating that poetry with maybe a mind to performing it versus writing a novel?
I had someone use a comparison that a short story or a poem is dating and a novel is a very long-term relationship. So it's definitely an investment of time. And I think between the two, it's all about stories. It's all about just having this idea of a voice or of someone's position or even an interaction and then always asking what if and then what and then what. And as you keep asking those questions, these imaginary characters become very real. These poems, you get beyond the easy facts and get to the so what. So being able to go through that process, and then once it's finished, you know, being able to share that work on stage or share that work in a workshop, it just adds another dimension, because now you're including other humans in the process. And as writers, it's used, and even dealt with making her collages, we're very solitary. It's us and our ideas and however we set up our creative space. So finding ways to let other humans into that creative space is always a really interesting venture.
Talking to Dasha Kelly, she's a writer, and Della Wells, a visual artist. They are Milwaukee's 2016 Artists of the Year. Reading both of your bios and all the stuff you're doing, I want to ask each of you this question. You're doing so much. How do you make time for your art? And Dasha, let's start with you. Does the time for writing just come naturally, or do you really have to make it happen?
Making it happen is the goal. I kind of steal minutes here and there, and always have this ambition of having that writing schedule, and every Tuesday at such and such a time. But because it's there, you know, I've really become committed and kind of obsessed with indoor plumbing and a roof and food. We have to do these other things on the side to make sure that our art is being supported, and we're also supporting our families. So it's really cramming it in and getting to a point where, you know, and it starts with us, where we have to be as protective of that creative time as we have our family and friends and coworkers and that kind of thing, to say, well, on Tuesdays at this time, I'm not available because I'm always writing or I'm always working on a show. And I just haven't found, it feels like a luxury to be able to do that. So I think, I know personally as an artist, and I've been creating and doing this work for many, many years, and I still have to give myself permission to set aside this time to create, because it is just me in this creative space, and it can feel very selfish and very indulgent, even though this is what makes me breathe, even though this is what fuels, you know, all of the work, vocation and avocation, that comes, you know, through this household.
And
so
Della,
I try to get it where I can.
And Della, I wanted to ask you the same thing. I mean, there's the dolls and the collages, and I think you're involved in a documentary and children's book illustrating and art organizations. Is it hard to find the time to sit down and make your art?
I think it is for most women to find the time to do anything. But, you know, like Dasha, you know, said, it's a commitment. You know, it's commitment to your craft. You have to make the time. You have to set aside time. And sometimes people don't understand it, but you have to do it for you. You have to make the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, Della, I found that seasonal works really well for me. I was at a conference within the last year or so, and it was a table of women, and we were just talking about all the things that we do and get done. And one of them was talking about how she functions in cycles, where she has this time. She knows that in the fall, for example, when she starts thinking of new works, and in the winter she crafts them, spring she starts to book them, and in the summer she's out and about. So she's not challenging and going against her natural grain in the summer to try to create work when that's when she's out and about. And it just made so much sense. And then we kind of fell into this really obvious conversation just about, you know, circadian cycles, and just we have functioned like that. And as women, humans in general, but particularly as women, you know, things are cyclical. So having that in my mindset this summer, I've kind of said it makes sense, because I'm not in as many meetings and running as much. So I'm making time in the backyard to do a lot more writing and reading.
Interesting. Does it flow like that for you too, Della?
Yes. And I think, and I don't know if Dasha would agree. I mean, I'm always thinking about art when I'm not working. Okay.
Yes.
And I always thinking about projects. But, you know, for me, you know, particularly, you know, being a senior, you know, I've learned you have to make time. I mean, you can be grandmother, great grandmother, mother, cook, basket maker, chef, whatever. You have to make time for you have to make time for yourself and make time for your craft.
I want to ask both of you about making art in Milwaukee. Dasha mentioned that the work you do can be solitary. Della, do you feel like you're part of, though, an art community in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I feel I'm part of the art community, but but for me, I agree with Dasha. The part of creating is solidarity, and doing it alone. But you know, I just don't, you know, it just don't show in Milwaukee. I talk to artists all of the countries, and some artists, you know, other parts of the world. So I feel part of the artist community, in general. not just Milwaukee.
And Dasha, do I have this right? You're involved with a collective, a writing collective?
Yes. Stillwater Collective is an outreach that I founded 16 years ago, and it was a way and a space for other artists, writers, performers, just to have, one, for us to support one another in the works and the projects that we have going on, and two, just to make a regular space for us to listen to one another, whether it's old works or new works or experiments and or showcases and bringing in outside guests and everything in the middle. So, and over the years, it's evolved to where probably 90% of our attention now is working with young people. So, again, teaching them, one, how to craft that, how to put form to that really loose emotion that we don't really know what to call yet. It's just disrupting everything, or it just is just hovering over this memory or attached to this person. So giving them the tool to be able to articulate that creatively, and then giving them the space to be able to share, so that as a collective, and they also build, you know, they build community, creating together in a very intimate experience. And you know, you can't help but see the human in other people when you're listening and encouraging and giving them voice when they're telling their stories. So this collective has grown to be multi-generational and definitely encouraging people throughout the city to listen and speak.
And briefly, Della, can you leave us, I'm sure a lot of our listeners maybe have that voice they want to find, whether it's art or writing or whatever. Can you give a quick bit of inspiration to someone to give it a try and find that artistic expression?
I say do it. When you receive criticism, take what you need, leave it. And finally, and I tell all artists this, don't believe your own hype. Because sometimes we can be so wrapped up in ourselves, you know, we can't get to the creative process. And, don't believe your hype.
Della and Dasha, congratulations again. Thanks for spending some of your valuable time with us, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, thank you.
We've been talking to Milwaukee's Artists of the Year. Della Wells is a visual artist. Dasha Kelly is a writer, a performer, and a social entrepreneur.
A recent study shows Americans are more divided along political lines than any time since 1992.
The Pew Research Center polled more than 4,000 Americans and found that a majority of people in both parties hold very unfavorable views of the opposing party.
The survey covered all sorts of things, like how people would describe those in the other party, how they feel about opposing political candidates, and whether or not respondents have any friends in the opposing party.
That partisan language can be seen in our political leaders. Here's President Obama talking about the struggle to fully staff the Supreme Court.
For more than 40 years, there's been an average of just over 2 months between a nomination and a hearing. I nominated Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court more than 3 months ago. But most Republicans so far have refused to even meet with them. They are allowing partisan politics to jeopardize something as fundamental as the impartiality and integrity of our justice system. And America should not let it stand.
That's on the Democratic side. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican, taking issue with Democratic lawmakers staging a sit-in on gun control issues.
Here's another one. If Democrats want to vote for a bill on the floor, there's a way to get one. It just takes 218 signatures on a petition, and then they can have a vote. It is that simple. That's how the House works. It's a well-known process. But they're not doing that. They are not trying to actually get this done through regular order. No, instead, they're staging protests. They're trying to get on TV.
Mike Wagner joins us now to talk about the rising levels of partisanship and how we got here. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, so Pew has been looking at levels of partisanship since the early 1990s, so about a quarter century here, and they're showing the highest levels now since 1992. What do you think is contributing to that rise? What do you see?
Well, I see a lot of things all contributing to the same outcome. So on the one hand, we have increasing economic inequality, and a lot of research has shown that as that increases, our lawmakers in Congress become much more divided. Other research shows that as lawmakers in Congress become more divided, that trickles down into the public because the lawmakers are sending clearer signals about what the parties stand for. That makes it easier for people to pick a side. Add all of that to kind of the new media environment that we're in, and we have a real acrimonious kind of political landscape right now. We hear a lot more of what we don't like about the other side. People can choose their own media in some respects and kind of only hear if they choose from a side where they're going to hear that they're right. And not only is the other side wrong, but the other side is dangerous, evil, not to be trusted. And we're seeing a lot of those kinds of things come out in this Pew data. It's not just that the parties think differently. It's that they are kind of even impugning the motives, the integrity, the personhood in some cases of the other side.
Is the rhetoric different than it used to be?
That's a great question. I don't know that on balance the rhetoric is different than it used to be. I think there is more of it, and it's harder to get away from. If you look back at some of the things that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams said about each other, you know, in the 1800, they were things that would make most people, you know, blush. And, you know, and so it's not that politicians who have been on opposite sides in political parties haven't been tough on each other and called each other names and called each other evil or dangerous or other kinds of things. But now it just keeps getting replayed ad nauseum. If I wanted to start a rumor about Thomas Jefferson, you know, in a presidential race a couple of centuries ago, I would have had to have waited for that to spread very slowly throughout, you know, the American countryside. And now if I want to do that, if I want to start a rumor about Governor Walker or President Obama, I could tweet it during the interview, and as many people who have access to my Twitter account can have it immediately. And so it's a lot easier for the rhetoric to bounce around and live longer, I think, than maybe it did in the past.
Right. So you mentioned the media and we talked about the rhetoric, but what about social media? That must have changed things quite a bit.
Social media seems to have played a role in some cases in enhancing people's kind of polarized views. But on the other hand, there's also some evidence that people who are social media users are more willing to hear what the other side has to say and are on the social media aspect for the opportunity to engage. And so it's not quite a one-to-one relationship. For some people, social media is a place where you can go and get more polarized. For others, you hear views from the other side and sometimes even moderate. And we see some of that in the Pew data where it talks about, you know, the more friends you have in the other party, the less likely you are to feel so coolly toward that other party.
Well, that's interesting. In this Pew data, they ask people, you know, how they would feel about someone coming into their community who was from the opposing political party as their own. And a lot of people said they would feel kind of uncomfortable, that it could be kind of tough. Do you think we're becoming less tolerant of political, I guess, political diversity, for one word?
There's a little bit of evidence that people who can afford to are sorting themselves to live in places where they are surrounded by people who are more like them. And so I think there is something to that. And, you know, most people on social media, even though social media does have some moderating effects associated with it, most people on there tend to search out websites that confirm what they think and confirm what they think about the other side. And so, you know, I think there is something to that.
We're talking about a new Pew study looking at high rates of political division, extreme partisanship, in fact, higher now than at any time in the last 25 years. And we're talking to Mike Wagner at the UW-Madison, where he's a journalism and mass communication associate professor. And, you know, so Mike, here we are. It's an election year. Does everything sort of get amped up, seen through that lens or thing? Are we getting a true read of where we are because of this election year?
Well, you know, I think we're getting a true read of where we are right now. And election years are often more partisan times because people's partisan affiliation is made more salient than it normally is. You know, on a Wednesday in an odd-numbered year, most people probably aren't thinking about the level of Democrat or Republican that they view themselves as. But in an election season, when the presidency is on the line, and especially in this year, where the primaries have received so much attention, largely because of Donald Trump, but also because of the history-making candidacy of Hillary Clinton and also the strong challenge from Bernie Sanders, all of those things have ratcheted up the heat, I think, a bit in this season. And it's not surprising at all to me, as someone who studies political parties and partisanship and polarization, that this time is an especially acute time of polarization.
So would you expect that to ebb no matter who wins once we come out of this acute polarized period, somebody gets elected and then we kind of get on with it? Or do you expect this to continue?
I think that after the election, we'll get on with it for a few weeks and then we'll likely revert back to a fairly polarized state. If you kind of take a look at the last several presidential elections, you know, the early approval ratings of George W. Bush and Barack Obama were quite high. Even amongst the other side, they were higher than they normally, you know, are. And fairly quickly, that goes away. And people view the White House through partisan blinders. They view Congress through partisan blinders. And they start to see politics in highly partisan ways. And so I suspect that this election won't break the fever of polarization.
Do you see anything cyclical here that you can point a finger to? Because we can look back in the 25 years, and it hasn't always been like this. There used to be people who worked together, more bipartisanship, more sort of the back room. You go in the back room, you hash it out, you come out with a deal, and that was politics. But it doesn't seem like that's politics anymore. It seems as though things are more divided, and one side goes their way, the other, and the twain does not meet so much anymore. So where are we in a cycle, if you can chart anything like that?
Well, you know, in terms of lawmakers, they have much less to do with each other on the other side than they used to. Lawmakers spent more time with each other. The work week in Washington was longer. They spent more time, with lobbyists, but across party lines. And so when lobbyists would take lawmakers to Scotland to go play golf, Republicans and Democrats would be on a plane together and would become friends. And now with the lobbying reform such as it is, and most people think that's a good thing, lawmakers tend to spend less time with each other and on the other side of the aisle and more time in their own caucuses and having less to do with each other. So there's something, I think there is something, you know, that's real there. The lawmakers spend less time with each other. Elections are so expensive and hotly contested and competitive, and the things that people say about each other are the kinds of things where I think it would be hard to show up, you know, and face a colleague at work if you said some of the things that, you know, the president and the speaker and others say about each other in the course of their day-to-day activities.
Well, looking at some of the emotions, the strong emotions that are associated with this partisanship, Pew surveyed people on whether they feel things like fear, anger, frustration when it comes to people across the aisle. And it seems as though, especially fear, a lot of from both parties saying, yes, the other party makes them afraid. What does that tell us about the emotions that are associated with all of this?
Well, first, I think it's something that has seemed to have, you know, fairly dramatically changed over the past couple of decades are the emotional attachments we have with our own party and especially the emotions we feel about the other side. And we really saw that, as you were just pointing out, in the Pew data. And so there's a deep level of distrust amongst the highly engaged. So those who are, you know, Democrats and are, you know, they think about that a lot and politics are really important to them. And the same for Republicans for whom politics is something they live and breathe. They really don't like the other side. They don't believe their motives. They think that they're dangerous in some cases. They literally fear them, or at least they tell pollsters that they fear them. They are angry at what the other side does. They're frustrated by what they see as brinksmanship or legislative maneuvering or unfair play. And those things are hard to overcome to make compromises, both from the lawmakers' point of view and from the electorate's point of view.
We're talking with Professor Mike Wagner right now about a new study that shows Americans are politically divided now more than at any time in nearly 25 years. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on the issue.
How do you feel about people in the opposing political party? Do you have friends or neighbors that you disagree with politically? Do you still get along despite your differences? Why do you think the partisan divide is so wide right now? What's causing that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now about new research that shows partisanship among Americans is at its highest point in nearly a quarter century. And you can join the conversation.
How do you feel about people from the opposite political party, the other point of view? Why can't we be friends? Do you have a hard time talking to people who disagree with you? Have you ended friendships, real or social media-wise, because of political differences? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Also curious about whether you think social media makes you more open-minded, as it sounds like some research suggests you find that. Call us at 800-642-1234. And we're picking up our conversation now with Mike Wagner from UW-Madison. We're going to take our first caller. We've got Lori on the line in Dodgeville. Lori, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe that the severe polarization in politics probably started when Obama was elected the first time. Because I think that gave, it's my opinion that that gave an immediate rise to the far right wing side of the Republicans. And it's a kind of a basic thought that, you know, when one side becomes strong, the other side gets stronger to fight it. And I think that both sides just became more polarized because of it. And I'm not saying that because, I mean, I voted for Obama both times. I mean, I think he's been a great president, but I do think that this is what started things becoming so divisive.
Lori, thanks a lot for that. And Mike, what do you think about that idea that was the first election of President Obama that caused, for some reason, a big reaction in the opposing party?
I can see where that feeling comes from. I think as we look at kind of the rhetoric we've seen in our politics since the Obama election, but the roots of polarization, at least according to political science types like myself, you know, started, you know, a couple of decades earlier when you had a growth of economic inequality, an expanding media landscape, and real political change. In 1994, the Republicans took the House of Representatives, you know, for the first time in maybe six decades. And so there was a real change. You had a Democratic president who'd won a three-way race in 1992. There was the reform candidate Ross Perot, who was the third-party candidate that year, who did unusually well for a third-party candidate. And then the Republicans took over Congress. President Clinton won re-election fairly easily. Then George W. Bush ekes out an election. But the partisan approval of George W. Bush, looking at Republicans who approved of him and Democrats, looks very similar to the Republicans and Democrats who approve of Barack Obama. And that was broadly true of President Clinton near the end of his time. Don't forget, President Clinton was impeached, you know, in a pretty acrimonious political setting in the 1990s as well. So the roots of this are fairly deep. But I think it's fair to say that presidents, and maybe this is especially true for President Obama, got a shorter honeymoon period, perhaps because of the exacerbating factors of all the different elements of polarization that have come to the fore in recent years.
Where do you place Wisconsin in the landscape of polarization? In the last, you know, what has it been, 5 years, people have been seeing Wisconsin as sort of this microcosm of political polarization, maybe more difficult here than in other places, but looking at this study, maybe not. What do you think?
How do you elect Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson to the U.S. Senate? How does Governor Walker win several statewide elections, survive a recall, and President Obama wins Wisconsin in relatively comfortable numbers both times? How does a state, you know, get to be like that? You know, and so Wisconsin in many ways is a microcosm or an example of the deep polarization in the country, which is to say that lots of places have people who have deeply held views on both sides and make you know, the elections hotly contested. And as you were pointing out, kind of in the introduction there, people literally have lost friendships over this. Kathy Kramer, a UW political science professor, chronicles some of this stuff in her book, The Politics of Resentment, which is about Wisconsin specifically. My own work with a lot of colleagues in my department and political science shows that people literally stopped talking to people who had other views about the recall. Up to a third of Wisconsinites reported to have stopped talking to someone else because of their views on the recall election. And so Wisconsin is one of the ground zeros of polarization in the United States.
Thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Bob joining us in Minneapolis. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What did you want to bring up?
So the question about whether I can be friends with, I'm a Democrat, an independent turned Democrat, and I absolutely have lots of friends who are Republicans and have had great ideological discussions with them over the years and about the importance of government intervention and the degree to which government can or cannot solve problems of ours. I find myself in a very different time right now because the Republican nominee for president to me is a racist demagogue, and it becomes a moral issue rather than an ideological issue. And so I am struggling to maintain relationships with those I know who support Donald Trump.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Donald Trump is a polarizing candidate, although I guess you could say Hillary Clinton is a polarizing candidate
right.
as well.
That's
so
right.
is it something about these particular candidates? They have huge unfavorable ratings among lots of people. So what do you say about
both
the candidates?
Candidates, both of the presumptive nominees are historically not well-liked. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Trump more so, but both of them have high negatives. One difference, aside from the way that they're conducting their campaigns, but one difference in kind of the public opinion data is that amongst Democrats, if you ask, so on a scale of 0 to 100, 100 is hot, 0 is cold, how warmly do you feel toward Hillary Clinton? The answer is in the high 70s. When you ask Republicans about Donald Trump, the answer is in the mid-60s. And so Republicans seem to be less wild about Donald Trump on average as compared to Democrats' feelings about Hillary Clinton. And so I think what Bob is feeling as an independent, maybe leaning Democrat is also what some Republicans are feeling about their own presumptive nominee.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Stefan, joining us in Caledonia. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, good afternoon. I have kind of a similar perspective in that I'm an independent. I'm also an atheist, and I also work for the state of Wisconsin. So I have kind of a moral issue regarding religion. Anytime it's brought up, I shy away from that candidate. I also support Bernie Sanders, and find that those of my friends that support Hillary Clinton would like to do away with me, at least politically.
All right, Stefan, thanks for that. I mean, these are two Democrats running. Mm-hmm. I guess Hillary is a presumptive nominee at
right.
this point. But what's going on when people, even within the same party, are feeling that acrimonious towards one another?
Well, that happens. I mean, that happened in 2008 with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and the worry in the Obama camp and amongst kind of the elite Democrats was, well, gosh, are the Hillary supporters going to be with us? And we heard that a lot about that in the news media. And then when John McCain picked Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential nominee, there was a flurry of news reporting saying, well, maybe this is a play for Hillary Clinton voters. But of course, it did not work out that way. And it's unlikely to work out that way this time. Sanders supporters are more likely than not to vote for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump in the election.
Stefan, thanks a lot. And on we go to Stephen calling, or rather Steve from Chicago. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I think probably one of the major factors in the divisiveness between the parties is the media, which allows members of each party to scare members of the other party by talking about irrelevant things such as who gets to marry who and the rights people have over their own body, as a way of detracting against the real issues, because if there was true informed journalism about things like the Trans-Pacific Pipeline, Monsanto, the food chain, poisoning the environment, then we'd have to have real change that would upset the economy of the entire nation.
Steve, thanks for that. Is the media focusing on the wrong stuff, trying to stir up the mud puddle, scaremonger, and not focusing on big policy issues?
Well, you know, the news media are stuck reporting what people are willing to tell them or show them or what they can dig up on their own. And they're also often reporting, especially with respect to television and cable television news, with what people are going to watch. And people watch those kinds of things more than anything else. And those issues are ones where there are deep divisions in the electorate. And so, you know, for some people like Steve, you know, abortion or same-sex marriage aren't important issues. But to those who would like to get married and weren't allowed to, or those who would want to have an abortion and couldn't, it's a very important issue. And so, you know, depending upon where you sit and what your views are, what the agenda ought to be is an issue where we're polarized. And I think we're seeing that, too. Some want to talk more economics trade. Others want to talk more social issues.
And, Mike, we just got a couple seconds left. But is anybody out there talking about beating the drum for political pluralism, for just getting along, realizing that we're going to have deeply held convictions that don't agree with somebody else's, and it's time to move past them?
It's difficult to move past them because most people hold their views honestly and think that they're right and would prefer that the society was, you know, governed and legislated in a way that went along with that. Plus, the people who are in the middle are just as divided from each other as those who are strong liberals and strong conservatives. A moderate, you know, that you might be talking to probably doesn't agree with a moderate that someone else might be talking to. And so they're also very different, which makes third parties really difficult.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That is Mike Wagner from UW-Madison talking about a new report finding that partisanship is at its highest point in nearly 25 years. New study from Pew Research.
Cottage Grove hosted a unique sporting event over the weekend. It was the U.S. Boomerang Association National Championships.
We posted a link to pictures from the Capital Times on the Central Time Facebook page, and they're worth a look because the boomerangs look kind of different than you might expect.
Yeah, if you're like me, you hear the word boomerang and you think a wooden thing. It's got kind of two prongs. They meet in the middle, kind of a curvy thing. No, I mean, they're there. Like, you see some of those. But how would you, I mean, they're not triangles, but there's these three-spoked and four-spoked things.
They look very different. I didn't know if there was such a thing as a traditional boomerang and a new wave boomerang, I'm sure is the technical term. But yeah, they have these sort of three prongs, and I guess they come back, though.
Right. Presumably, that's the goal. And maybe they're high-tech. There's this whole new world of boomerangs we're being exposed to here. So check out the pictures. I wish I'd actually caught the competition. I was traumatized, I told you earlier, by one of those old-fashioned
boomerangs. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Boomerangs. I had shop class, middle school, which didn't go great. I wasn't very good at shop. But the shop instructor had made his own boomerang, took us outside, threw it, and it went off course, and everybody scattered except me, and I ended up having to dive and roll to not be hit by this traditional boomerang. So I should have gone this weekend and confronted my fears at long last.
Yeah, we need to have some more exposure therapy for boomerangs.
Boomerang
maybe here in the studio.
Exactly.
I'll shoot it at you during the show, and you'll get right over it.
The engineers will love that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.